Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I am joined by Sara Gunn. Sara, how are you doing?
Well, I have a four-letter word. It's called rain.
Wonderful. Yes, we had some lovely rain in Johannesburg last night, bringing a bit of an end to the scorching, sweltering heat of early spring. We are also joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
I just reiterate the whole rain point.
Yes. Let us perhaps, though, for our first story today, talk about something that we do not need. This is a story from IOL, which is the media organization most closely associated with being the kind of pro-Zuma, anti-Cyril Ramaphosa, but still pro-ANC media house in the country. And they ran an article with the headline, Lindiwe Sisulu's ANC presidential campaign takes off. And this was reporting from one of their subsidiaries, the Daily News, which says that it has learned that Lindiwe Sisulu's name has been raised by various regions and subregions across the length and breadth of the country. She was also apparently being backed by some ANC Women's League regional structures to run for the presidency. And it is yet to be seen whether her ambitions will get the nod from the ANC Women's League national structures. In the Western Cape, she's said to be enjoying big support from the Boland, Karoo, and Overberg regions. And the article is sort of filled with quotes from lower-ranking ANC people talking about how she is, the right person to take over the party from Ramaphosa. As one of the people praising her, quoted here, says, Minister Sisulu has never disappointed when given a political responsibility. so this raises the question. Firstly, I think it's quite funny, this piece in general, because it's very obviously written as a pro-propaganda piece. But that being said, this raises the question, and let me start with you, Sara. Would Minister Sisulu be a good president? And more than that, does she have any shot of becoming president, do you think?
She might become president just on the basis of, oh, my God, we better put in a woman. I wouldn't put that past the ANC because by all and she'll get a shot because she's well-dressed. But my general impression is
she's also royalty of the ANC,
yes,
right?
Royalty, her father was. That's a pretty slim basis for describing yourself as royalty. So, you know, good guy as her father was. I don't think the same extends to her. I think she's not hot on the invite list, though she, as I say, she does dress well. She's slim and very presentable, but I think she's not that likable, but more than that is I think she has been consistent as a politician. I think she's done badly in every ministry she's been in charge of. And I think if I remember correctly, it's housing, water, foreign affairs, military. She is not a great minister. She has not achieved great things. And I just, let's put it this way. It would be probably a bit in line with what's come before since Thabo Mbeki. But as an astute leader of men, women, people, not so much.
Terence, your thoughts on President Sisulu? She's been in the ANC for a really long time. She's held some important positions in cabinet. She's been in the water department. She's been in defense. And I think currently she's
tourism.
Where is she now? Tourism or something now.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I mean, I suppose I could say that when I reach that age, I hope I look as good as she does. But I don't think that really is the key qualification for leading this great republic of ours. Although by the standards of what has gone before, as you say, kind of since the Becky era, you know, the size of the shoes one needs to fill is not, you know, gargantuan. Look, yeah, as a minister, I think she performed indifferently. She was the Minister of Defense for a while, and the complaints about what's happened to South Africa's defense capability are legion. More to the point, the whole water issue. And she was the subject of what can be described as a ministerial downgrade. You know, you get fired in this country, you get downgraded maybe, or you get laterally promoted or whatever. But I mean, to go from water, housing, and sanitation, which are, you know, important sort of quality of life issues, to tourism, that is, that's not a propitious state of affairs.
It's so much of tourism that they put Martinez van Schalkwyk there for a while.
No, look, I mean, I don't know what, like, arts and culture or something is maybe one step below. No, it's not a plum posting, and she seems to be, you know, put in charge of the caucus as it was being stripped down by COVID and lockdown. So, you know, don't think she really had much of a chance to shine there. That I think tells its own story. No stranger to controversies, the old N2 gateway project, the Paul Ngubeni hiring, etc. Look, you know, I suppose in her defense, she is she's energetic and she's quite articulate. Perhaps with the right set of advisors, she might be able to make a success out of it. But you know, I think, irrespective of the merits of any one candidate, the environment that anyone is going to preside over has been so fatally compromised by you know, things like the politicization of the state, the lack of consequences for malfeasance, that what does one really expect? You know, a mess has been made, and there seems to be very little appetite to even want to try and correct it.
So, for what it's worth, I don't think she's got that much of a shot, really, at becoming ANC leader. But, Sarah, I just want your thoughts on why perhaps the anti-Ramaphosa ANC camp seems to be propping her up. I mean, this is in this article was from media that's favorable to them. Why do you think they're going for her as a potential replacement for Ramaphosa, or at least a challenger to him?
Yeah, well, if it's just sort of the pro-Zuma crowd, it probably goes on sort of trying to put forward all the things that haven't been put forward before, as I say. And the fact that she's a woman, I think, meets that need. Her being struggle royalty gives them some clout, some credence. I wouldn't imagine, given the state of our leadership on either side of the divide, that they care whether she's any good at the job or not. I just don't think that's the issue. I think she's a kind of maybe a sort of safe-ish personality by virtue of the previous two comments I made, in that she's not really one nor the other. So she's, on the whole, she should get the backing just because she's a woman from the ANC Women's League, although the ANC Women's League, like much of the ANC, is never, one side's never in agreement with the other side. I think that's probably, it's probably as simple as that. I'm just fascinated by the human proclivity to want a position that you neither deserve nor can you successfully fill, but affects a lot of people.
Well,
I certainly don't see her as the person who can bring the party together.
Look, I think that I'd just like to tack two things on there. First of all, the ANC, I think, has wrapped itself up in the idea that the party does not so much control the state as use the state to unify and keep the party going. I mean, that's patronage and whatever. And you know, she has, and I think this is not common in the ANC, and I think technically frowned upon, she has declared her interest in holding a position like that before. So, you know, she's someone who's like raised a flag. Now, I think that that is actually quite positive, rather than the sort of shadow boxing where people are campaigning but swearing blind that they're not. You know, she's at least had the gumption to say that she wants this office. So yeah, you know,
frankly, I would say give it to anyone who wants it.
never a dull moment in this great republic.
Indeed. Speaking of which, there is an organization. Let's move on to our next story, and that is concerning an organization which we have heaped a lot of criticism on in the past, which is, of course, the South African Human Rights Commission. However, there's been an interesting development. According to a piece on the Sowetan, the SA Human Rights Commission has ordered the Pan-African Congress, which I'm not sure if it still has any seats in Parliament anymore, to drop its one settler, one bullet slogan and apologize for having used it or face legal action. The commission found that the former liberation slogan constituted hate speech, harassment on the basis of race, dissemination of an idea which propagates the incitement of racial violence, and that it was not protected by the right to freedom of expression. So this finding was after complaints that were made in the aftermath of the Brackenfell High School incident in Cape Town, when the EFF and the PAC appeared outside this high school to protest what they said was a racially segregated matric farewell. The South African Human Rights Commission has said that if the PAC does not comply with its instructions, it will then take them to the Equality Court and seek damages, basically, from the party, including financial compensation. So, Terence, let me start off with the sort of, I think, fairly quick to answer question. Is there a freedom of speech defense for what the PAC slogan was here? And what do you make of this case in general?
Well, my view is yes. But then, you know, I take a very, very expansive view of freedom of expression. Let's say I think what's kind of become the dominant question when discussing it is, where do we draw the line? And my response to that is as narrowly and as sparingly as one can. If I was an advisor for the PAC, incidentally, if you look at the Human Rights Commission's website, they refer to the PAC in their original statement as the Positive Action Campaign. I'm not sure if there's like a different PAC or if, someone just like maybe was working very late that night and needed to shove something in there. I don't know. If I was an advisor there, I would say, well, you're talking about history. You're talking about the slogans of political parties, that this is all metaphorical, blah, blah, blah. I think I could sort of make an argument for that. On the other hand, I think in terms of the way South Africa has kind of conceptualized this, that hate speech, you know, is built around, and Sarah with a legal background can correct me if I'm wrong, but the implication that you intend to, that you're inciting causing of harm and that sort of thing, that would make this a hate speech issue. Now, as I say, on principle, I'm not wild about hate speech legislation. I think if you can prove incitement, that's one thing. Hate speech, I think, starts to muddy it, and then we get into, well, you know, it offends my feelings, but whatever. So I think within South Africa's its official terms of reference, this seems to be entirely what was envisaged. In terms of a freedom perspective, I would say we should be cautious about it. Beyond that, I'd just like to make one other point. About 2 years ago, an official of the Human Rights Commission said that they treat complaints of racism against black people and white people differently based on historical context. This is a very interesting case because, if I was the PAC, it's precisely that historical context that I would be invoking. So I don't know. Can one ask the question whether the Human Rights Commission is in fact operating according to any kind of fixed set of rules, or are these sort of things that shift around with moods?
Can I make another suggestion? It's a bit like slapping a toddler on the tortoise. You know, it's, you know, the PAC, whichever version, whether the Pan-Africanist Congress or the Positive Action, whatever.
Campaign.
It's like the South African Human Rights Commission is sitting there saying, how do we make white people happy? Let's make a finding against a black grouping that doesn't matter. I mean, you know, if the EFF had sung it, I would be far more nervous, and it would be more important whether it was considered hate speech, and if it was, that they were punished for it. But, you know, I can't get that excited about the PAC in any format whatsoever. And I, along those lines of, well, we treat people differently depending where they come from, but we want to sometimes be seen to satisfy the white guys who don't deserve to be treated particularly well because they were the oppressor. Let's have a little wing ding at these guys. I can't take it terribly seriously. I have to say, that's not to say it wasn't offensive or concerning in the moment, but in the larger historical context, not much.
Well, yeah, look, I'll actually take that one step further. It was about 10, 12 years ago. Zwelinzima Vavi said something about, we'll shoot and kill. And that was then taken to the Human Rights Commission and went back and forth. And eventually they released a statement saying, they've discussed this with him and they sort of accept his explanation. And in their own statement, it said something like, it quoted Vavi as saying, I was simply pointing out that comrades must stand up for each other, which at times may involve killing. I understand that this is jarring or something to that effect, and I apologize for any sensitivities hurt. But, you made it very clear that killing is on the table. The Human Rights Commission then said, well, you know, we accept this and we consider the matter closed. Very interesting, their statement, which is no longer on their website, but I think that's because they redesigned their website and this sort of fell in the earlier era, did not include a contact detail for, you know, media queries. I sent a few emails to them asking, just can they clarify under what circumstances violence is acceptable? And actually received an acknowledgement, but I never received the answer. Interesting.
So what
happens in those offices, I think, can be strange.
Who knows? Crazy in those offices.
So as for the group in question here, I think that this is a breakaway faction of the PAC who adopted a different name with the same initials. Kind of, if anyone's followed the PAC in the aftermath of 94, it had like a million splits. The two biggest were, I think, the PAC and the APC. and I think their leadership battle was just decided in court recently. I'm not really sure what they're fighting over because there's not much of a party left. But anyway,
I think there's something inspiring when you are willing to, like, you know, they had all on the line for a name or an actor. Right. I mean, you know, they can't be able to tell his children, I was the last genuine one.
All right, let us go on to the story that's been covered as the headline in all the mainstream papers. And that is that the health minister has assured the nation that by the end of business on Thursday, six officials implicated in the Digital Vibe scandal will be served with suspension letters. He said, quote, by the close of business today, all affected six officials in the Department of Health would be served with suspension letters pending the completion of disciplinary hearing processes and formalization of charges. The outstanding disciplinary investigations will require the investigators communicating with the special investigating unit and with a procurement specialist. This is after the report, which was done by the special investigative unit into the health department and former health ministers, William Kesey, and his department's contract with a company called Digital Vibes. It was received by President Ramaphosa in June. The Daily Maverick reported that it implicated William Kesey and his son. Zuma sort of kind of defended William Kesey, although William Kesey then subsequently resigned. And the report was finally made public on a Wednesday, which was far more damning of William Kesey than I think the initial impressions had been given. It said that he had acted unlawfully and that his son had benefited from these tenders very directly. Sara, what do you make of this?
I wasn't sure if I quite followed it, but I'm assuming what they're doing is they're giving out suspension letters today, meaning those people will be suspended until disciplinary hearings are convened, etc., which would make sense. The government doesn't often follow its own labor legislation, so this is nice to see. But it would help if the hearings were held, say, within the next 2-3 weeks. That's how these things should be done. And by all accounts, this SIU can you know, can really, someone can come in and give the evidence and Bob's your uncle. But the other thing that's intriguing is the how much opprobrium came down on former acting Director General Anban Pillay. He was just one of those people I didn't warm to. And one of the reasons I didn't warm to him is because he was the front man for, I think it was then, Erin Motsoaledi's push for the National Health Insurance. Now, Mkhize is also a great supporter of the National Health Insurance. And there's a sort of moral pleasure in seeing the people who are great supporters of NHI seeing their political arse, so to speak. And it does, of course, raise the question as to whether they were so pro-NHI, not because of the people needed the health, which I don't think they'd have got anyway, but because the amounts of money that were going to flow through NHI would be so huge that retirement benefits would certainly accrue to those who stole this from them. And I'm not sure that these two gentlemen were not amongst those who intended to benefit. So I am not surprised that Pillay is there. And if it's done any damage to the NHI, great.
My theory about the strong push from Zweli Mkhize for the NHI was that he did run for ANC president in the past, and that he hoped by gaining control of the NHI would essentially turn the health department to the largest bastion of patronage in the country, and that he would then use that to elevate himself through the ranks of the party. And it's interesting, I can't help but see the fingerprints of ANC internal fighting all over this. Although it's a bit complicated because Ramaphosa has continued to be really nice about Zweli Mkhize. He hasn't really criticized him much. He said, I think that he was
Won't he? Because Zweli Mkhize is in the back foot.
Right. So, Terence, what do you make of this story?
Well, look, I mean, I think the push for the NHI, I think, follows a sort of, let's say, ideological logic on the one hand. The idea that you want equal health care, and I think that's very appealing, whatever equal may mean. I suspect that equal probably means, you know, clinics for the population, and then for a select few, gated military hospitals or, you know, sponsored treatment in Sweden or wherever. Look, I mean, Russia, maybe. I mean, remember that Julius Nyerere, you know, always regarded his, village pharmacies as, you know, as one of his great achievements. And I do think there's something there. But he died in a private clinic in London, so the not for me sort of thing. On the other hand, you know, I think as night follows day, even if one, you know, is a confirmed and resilient supporter of state mediated healthcare, this is going to be used for patronage and corruption. That is the way the South African state is structured. And I think that although we have a depth, well, actually we don't always, but I'm saying that among some people, we have enough depth of sophistication not to use the term patronage or corruption. But I mean, from what I've seen, it's very clear that you know, procurement will be subject to BEE legislation or whatever. Of course, that's going to be used to continue what has been done, and we know that this is not going to be fundable out of existing taxes. So yes, you know, you are looking at how you can either nationalize existing private schemes or redirect all that spending because they simply won't exist, and you can then just, you know, raise those premiums and taxes, you know, and almost certainly not at that level either, because it's a common feature around the world, even where these schemes are very well managed, that they always have a kind of insatiable hunger for more money. And, you know, that is kind of where it'll go. You know, this is not Canada or Sweden or whatever, where, you know, you have your NHI equivalent and you have a competent bureaucracy to oversee it. You know, and let me say, whatever my own, ideological normative views. I was the benefit of a system like this in Taiwan for a number of years. It worked very well there. But even in Taiwan, I mean, there were constant complaints about how do we fund this? How do we fund this? Population structure changing or whatever. That's a wealthy, well-run country. We're not Taiwan, and I don't think we're going to go and ask the Taiwanese if we can borrow their like health bureaucracy to run it. So, yeah, you know, sad but true. This would have been the next big game in town.
Speaking of borrowing things from foreigners, or in this case, maybe not borrowing, maybe just getting, there is much talk in the world right now about climate change, emissions, energy, the big conference between global leaders. I think it's COP26, I think I'm correct in saying, about how to fight climate change, is coinciding with some fuel shortages in the UK as well as some massive electricity problems in China. And South Africa has thrown in its two cents in this debate. Our envoys who were meeting with people from the United States, Britain, Germany, and France have said that South Africa is going to need major financial support from the West if it wants to move away from coal. This according to people from the Environmental Department. The Environmental Department said, while South Africa is committed to a just transition to cleaner energy sources, we need certainty of financing to accelerate this transition. We do need an irrevocable agreement that we can sign at COP26. And then basically said that any Western aid to South Africa should bear in mind our financial constraints. I must say, Sarah, I kind of respect the hustle on this one.
Absolutely. It's like a 219 scam. Let's put it this way. If we've undertaken, apparently, to bring forward the date of zero carbon emissions, which is absolutely striking, given the fact that we can't even keep our carbon emitters functioning until we replace them. So be that as it may.
But right. And more than that, the whole idea of using nuclear power has been poisoned in this country because of the way that Jacob Zuma treated it during his administration.
Absolutely. Which I think is the biggest tragedy of the lot. But basically, I kind of I'm with the ANC on the hustle on this one, because if the world insists on reducing carbon emissions to zero and carbon dioxide is not the most poisonous of emitters, then they want the developing world to do so, even though they don't appear to have any understanding of how the developing world is going to develop without some relaxation of the demand of net zero carbon dioxide emissions. So who's going to, if they want us to do it, they must pay us to do it. And I'm absolutely with them on that. But, you know, it's going to green is going to be hugely expensive. I don't think, broadly speaking, the first world understands the extent to which development in the developing world will be completely hampered by only green energy. So, as I say, if they must pay for it if they want us to do it, and we haven't got the money, of course, so they must pay for us, and we'll see if we do it or not.
Terence, your thoughts?
Well, first of all, is this specifically South Africa's talking to the quote West?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I don't know what happened to BRICS that was going to revolutionize the world. I mean, surely the Russians and the Chinese can bung us a few monkeys or something. And it's like
I haven't heard BRICS mentioned for ages.
Well, you know, like I suppose you have to go where, you know, the hustle will be received.
It doesn't help that Brazil and India are at the moment on a very different page to Russia and China.
Yeah, look, and it probably also doesn't help that we probably laughed out of town in Shanghai if we went. But no, okay. I think that for me, one of the interesting things is that South Africa has since the 1990s been very, very proud with good reason for the fact that it has not been a major recipient of aid or hugely reliant on aid. So South Africa has generally been able to meet its expenses from its own pocket or by borrowing, you know, commercially. This seems to indicate a major change of course. Now, yes, you know, I also remember President Ramaphosa saying, you know, like our fiscal situation is tight or whatever. Well, you know, one has to ask how we got into that position. You know, it's like when I went to the casino and maxed out my credit card. You know, my bank manager was not impressed when I said I am facing some financial. He said, "Let's see what you've been spending your money on." We had all this money, but it's like all in Dubai or it got spent in Kantla and fire pools and swimming pools and whatever. I think that we South Africans actually need to be a little bit cynical of this, that we are in this hole not because, you know, there is some big impersonal force operating, but because of the chronic mismanagement of this country and because of conscious choices, which even now President Ramaphosa refuses to step away from. That's why I can go to the Zondo Commission and get really animated about, we're going to carry on doing our cadre deployment, but the new cadre deployment is going to be great. You're going to love it. Cadre deployment to make cadre deployment great again. I've even got the sort of cadre deployment at cap now. I am sensing a sort of change. You know, it's just a sort of finger in the wind thing, but a change in the direction of, we are proud, resilient country. If you want to, like, you know, pass me a bit, I'll take it. I don't know. That could be very significant in years coming forward. Incidentally, one other thing, from the point of view of those Western countries, this has become a big political issue in places like Germany. And I think this is a way that they feel they can engage with the developing world on a sort of equal basis, and one that, you know, speaks to humanitarianism and whatever, and also doesn't get them, you know, mixed up with the unpleasant sides of politics. So, you know, rather than talking about corruption and mismanagement in the country, we help you with your just energy transition. And that means we're being good neighbors, but we're not, you know, putting any pressure on you. No pressure, guys. No pressure.
What fun. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We are a bit over time. So thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show and have a most excellent, fantastic, and wonderful weekend. Cheers, everyone.